Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Today, the two guests mandated by the invisible and possibly dead gods, Robert Fatton, will tell us what's going on in Haiti, and Steve Fraser will analyze and mourn the death of the future. Haiti, which was already coping with intense poverty and chaos, has now fallen even deeper into that morass. Gangs have largely taken over Port-au-Prince, where they control 60-80% of the capital city, depending upon whose estimates you follow, and the Prime Minister, Ariel Henry, tendered his resignation pending the formation of a transitional government. Any new government is likely to be imposed by the U.S. and its imperial junior partners, just as Henry himself was installed in July 2021, following the assassination of President Jovenel Moïse, an assassination Henry was probably involved in. There haven't been elections in 8 years, and even those are profoundly dubious. For more, we're joined by a frequent Behind the News guest, Robert Fatton, a professor of government and foreign affairs in the Department of Politics at the University of Virginia. His 2002 book, Haiti's Predatory Republic, is an excellent primer for understanding how the country, led by an elite whose major occupation is looting the state rather than running a profitable capitalist economy, got to this miserable place. Robert Fatton. The current Prime Minister, Ariel Henry, deeply unpopular and with no legitimacy, agreed to step aside and make way for a transitional government. There was a conference in Jamaica, which Haitian politicians listened into by Zoom, weird detail, where a group of countries tried to put together a transitional government. What's going on here? Who are they? What's going on?
Clearly, the crisis in Haiti is acute, and the U.S. with CARICOM has tried to find a solution that is coming very late in the ball game. At any rate, what happened in Jamaica is that there was a proposition for a presidential council. It would regroup 7 different political or civic movements. And so far, we don't have the exact composition of that presidential college or council, however you want to call it. There are divisions within that council, in any case, because there are political differences, personality differences, and the idea of having 7, people presiding and then picking a prime minister, I think is a recipe for disaster, because they don't agree on much except that they don't want to deal with the gangs. And the problem for them, clearly, is that the gangs are now so entrenched in Port-au-Prince, they control something like 80% of the capital city, that it's difficult to see how any government can avoid dealing with the gangs, especially that the gangs have told those people in Jamaica that they don't give a damn about what's happening in Jamaica, and that what they want is an internal presidential council, which would be headed by Guy Philippe, who was once upon a time a coup leader against Aristide. Then he was jailed in the United States and convicted for money laundering. And he was released last October, came to Haiti, and now he has created a movement which is called the National Awakening. And that National Awakening has proposed a tripartite presidential council, but obviously the fellow who's in charge would be Guy Philippe. Now, there is a kind of a twist because there is another political figure of some significance in Haiti, a fellow by the name of Moïse Jean-Charles. And Jean-Charles has essentially accepted the proposition of Guy Philippe, but at the same time, he has decided that he would join also the Jamaican agreement. And the two agreements are incompatible because Guy Philippe is clearly connected to the gangs because the gangs, that's what they want, that tripartite presidential council. But Moïse Jean-Charles is in both camps. Supposedly today he was going to announce something. I haven't heard anything so far. So we have to wait. The agreement is, to a large degree, is fabricated by the United States. the U.S. has waited 2.5 years after banking exclusively on the departing prime minister. And 2.5 years ago, the same propositions had been put forth by, in particular, the civil society movement, which is called Montana, which is probably the most coherent of the movements. And the U.S. ignored it and never put any real pressure on Ariel Henry. And now, 2.5 years afterwards, that's what they are trying to impose. The policy of the U.S. is in complete disarray, because even if you install that government that they fabricated in Jamaica, then you have to deal with the violence in the streets. And the gangs are not ready to be quiet if they are not part of the solution. And this is a real problem for any type of decent government. So I don't know what's going to happen. And there is the added problem of the Kenyan contingent. And let me put that in context. 2 years ago, Ariel Henry had asked for an intervention, a foreign intervention in Haiti to squash all of the gangs. Initially, the U.S. Wanted to send Mexico or Brazil, then it was Canada. They couldn't find anyone. Last year, they signed an agreement with Kenya, a security agreement with Kenya, because Kenya is involved in Somalia in the Congo. And that security agreement is $500 million for 5 years. And I think this is at that time that the U.S. said, why don't you go to Haiti and we'll add another $200 million to the funding? And Kenya said yes. So they are supposed to send 1,000 officers.
I was thinking 1,000 cops really wouldn't be able to handle these gangs.
But what is even more amazing is that now we are learning that only about 400 of them are trained and ready to go. But the Kenyans have asked for $200 million, and so far I think they're only $100 million. So it's not clear whether they are growing. And the Kenyans have also asserted that there is no way they are going to send their contingent of police officers unless there is a working government in Port-au-Prince. And at the moment, there is no working government in Port-au-Prince, and it's not clear that you can get one, because the gangs have said that any government that tries to come right now, especially a government that is created by the Jamaican agreement, well, they will create hell in the streets of Port-au-Prince. So I don't know what is going to happen. The situation is really one of catastrophic proportion. You have about over 350,000 people in Port-au-Prince who've been displaced. They are living in horrible camps. There is an acute shortage of food. All hospitals are closed. The international airport is closed. And the gangs have surrounded the key sites of Port-au-Prince, the airport, the National Palace. You know, it's an encirclement. Port-au-Prince is in a state of siege, as it were. And having a political solution at this moment, it seems that it's perilously late.
Now, the other day, Matthew Miller, the State Department spokesman, said, what happens now is not a decision for the United States, which struck me because, among other things, the United States has done that many times in the past. Why would it change now? What is he talking about? It is, to some degree, a decision of the United States, isn't it?
Yeah, to a large degree, it is. Because the reunion in Jamaica, the U.S. was quite clearly present. The U.S. has the money. The U.S. can decide what the heck is going to happen. There's a former American diplomat by the name of Tom Shannon who used to be involved in previous crises in Haiti, and he declared in an interview last week that what the United States has to do and will do is essentially tell the people that they need a government and they will form the government for them. So I mean, this is pretty clear. I don't think there is any solution in Haiti without massive involvement of the United States. And any government that crystallizes is to a large degree accepted, if not totally created by the U.S.
It's easy to complain about foreign meddling, and God knows I just did it, but are there any forces in Haiti that could right the ship now?
In Haiti, that's difficult to see, because even the parties that are part of that agreement, many of them were members of previous governments. Many of them have been involved in bizarre political deals. So there is nothing that emerges from that agreement that gives great confidence. There is that group, the Montana group, which seems to be the more coherent group. But on the other hand, it's a group which is composed of mainly highly educated people. They have some trade union members, but the leadership is really very educated Haitians. And they are kind of divorced from the overall population. They have good ideas, but they've never been able to really ground their coherence in a popular movement. The other groups have much more capacity to put people in the streets than the Montana civil society group. But on the other hand, those may be, the Montana group may be the only one that has, to some extent, a coherent program. But if they enter into that coalition, which they have, it's difficult to see how their program is going to be enacted, given the presence of different actors who are actually, some of them were in the previous government of Jovenel Moïse, some of them are in the government of Martelly, and that is not necessarily the best indication of a solution to the very deep problems that Haiti faces.
Is there anything like a political class in Haiti, a group of people within the elite who are experienced in running the show?
Those are the people in the agreement in Jamaica. The agreement in Jamaica has one thing that seems to be a good thing, and that is that it excludes people who are criminals or who have a criminal past.
Now that's a pretty large exclusion.
Well, I mean, this is where we are, you know, but that's a good thing. And I thought that that meant that all of the politicians who had been sanctioned by Canada, the United States, and France for corruption, etc., would be excluded. But I just learned this morning that, no, those guys, while they may be sanctioned for corruption, etc., they may be part of the game at one point or another. So in other words, the political class that is dealing with the crisis now, there are some new elements, but the overwhelming majority has been the political class of Haiti for the last, 30 years or so.
I'm speaking with Robert Fatton, a professor of politics at the University of Virginia. And now the gangs. It's always been a problem. Gang violence has always been a problem in Haiti, but it's certainly got worse recently. Why did it get worse, and who exactly are these gangs? Do they have ties to other social forces?
The gangs were initially created and funded by different political parties, members of the business class, etc. So they are not something that just came out of the blue. What is different now is that a fellow who is the main leader, a fellow by the name of Jimmy Cherizier, is known also as Barbecue, he has, to a large degree, managed to establish his own autonomy vis-à-vis those who nurtured them. The rumor in Haiti is that Cherizier and his gang, which is the dominant gang, were initially funded by the previous regime of Jovenel Moïse. Now, when Jovenel Moïse died, there was a break because the party of Jovenel Moïse exploded, and Cherizier became an increasingly autonomous person. He became his own kind of messianic leader. And what is important to know is that while in the past they were essentially funded by those elites, now they have a capacity to fund their own kind of military formations, as it were. They get their money because of kidnappings, ransom. They also have established kind of a tax system because they control the main arteries in Port-au-Prince, and in particular the one that leads to the oil depot, which are critical for any functioning structure in Haiti, electricity, etc. And if a truck goes by, you have to pay a tax. They have accumulated their own private coffers of wealth. In addition, they are linked to the drug business, probably the cartels in Mexico. Haiti is a passageway, as it were, from Colombia back to the United States. And they are involved in the small arms trafficking with countries like Jamaica, Trinidad, etc. And finally, now that they control essentially everything in Port-au-Prince, they are capable of demanding from anyone whatever they want, in particular ransoms. So while initially they may have been dependent on some of the big interests in the economy and in the political system, now they are the power unto themselves. They've become significant. And last week, what was even more alarming was that Cerisier Barbecue federated with another huge gang, which is the enemy, was the enemy of the gang of Barbecue. And that federation has been able to do serious damage to the police. They've attacked the National Palace. They've surrounded the National Palace. They've attacked, you know, the airport, which is closed. So now you have a federated armed militia, as it were, which is quite sophisticated. I mean, drones have been used by the gangs in order to free prisoners and in particular gang members from all of the jails in Port-au-Prince. So you're talking about an increasingly powerful, violent, and determined army of bandits. Those fellows are mostly from the slums. They are young men in general, and the future for them has always been horrible. So, you know, a significant minority of them decided that their future was better secured if they joined a gang, if they had a gun, and if they could make easy money. Some of the leaders of the gangs were former police officers. And actually, Cerisier was an officer in the Haitian police. And he was, I think, at one point accused of corruption, etc. And then he decided to create his own gang, and he became the leader of that gang. And Cerisier sees himself as a revolutionary. He calls himself the Che Guevara or the Fidel Castro. Sometimes it's Mandela. Sometimes it's Martin Luther King. I mean,
I don't think he has an ambitious social vision, though, does he?
No. Yeah, you can say that again, indeed. You know, but he's a very serious guy in terms of his determination to get power. And he's always on social media. He talks continuously on YouTube. He has a certain charisma. It's such a horrible situation that people like Cerisier appear to some as some sort of revolutionary figure. So the danger is that if those guys take power, it's not clear what the hell is going to happen in the country.
What do they want from power? I mean, aside from more opportunities to loot.
Cerisier has a vision that he wants to create a new Haiti. What that vision is, I have no idea. He has vague statements that he's going to take from the rich and give to the poor. But the people who have really suffered from the consequences of his gang are the very poor people. Most of the people who are in the camps and are internal refugees, as it were people from the slums in Cité Soleil. And it's the violence of his gang that has compelled all of those poor people to exit. And they have nowhere to go. So this is a really bizarre vision if you're going to make a revolution, that the first thing you do is that you really do damage to the existence of the extremely poor. Now, on the other hand, Cerisier has his own turf, and his own turf is like a Don Corleone. He's the boss. So he gives you something in return for total allegiance to his persona.
Now, these folks in Jamaica can appoint whoever they want to high office, but is there anything like the functioning machinery of government bureaucracy, the kind of thing that make a society run on a day-to-day basis? That just doesn't exist, does it?
It has completely collapsed. The government last week established a state of emergency and a curfew. No one pays attention to it, and they don't have the capacity to enforce it. The ministries of the government, many of them have been burned. Some of them have been occupied by the gangs. So you have no functioning state. And the weakening of the state is something that goes way back to the structural adjustment programs of the IMF and the crazy idea that NGOs could do it better than any type of state. So the state is now a shallow institution, and now it has completely collapsed. I mean, you don't have a functioning government in Haiti now. There is really no structure.
As you've written, the whole ruling class of Haiti for a very, very long time has been based on kleptocracy, stealing things, not making anything. It's never been a proper bourgeoisie in any sense. So they really set quite the example for these gangs, didn't they?
The former president, who used to be a singer, he had a very popular song, and the title of the song was "The Legal Bandits and the illegal bandits. So the legal bandits were essentially people like the president, and the illegal were the people outside of established society. So you're right. I mean, what the gangs are doing is not fundamentally different in terms of conceptualizing the way you accumulate wealth to just do what they are doing, steal it or extract it from the weakest segment of the population. Occasionally, those who are wealthy have to pay too, but it's not, you know, it's exactly that. The example that was set by the rulers is to a large degree what those at the bottom, at least in the gangs, are following. This is indeed the ugly reality of the system. And the gangs are saying so too.
That singer, of course, is Sweet Mickey. What happened to him?
Sweet Mickey, it's not clear where he is now. He may be in Miami, he may be in Haiti. He is in the background. He hasn't played a significant role yet. He's been sanctioned, actually, by Canada. I mean, in other words, his assets have been frozen. The United States has not sanctioned him. So I don't know if the United States is using him as a potential card. Not clear. We'll just have to wait and see. But he has supporters in Haiti, and some of the members of Jovenel Moïse's party, who was chosen by Martelly to become the president, well, some of those fellows are actually part of the Jamaican agreement. So he's not completely out of the picture.
And you talked about this a bit, but I imagine the situation for the Haitian population is just horrible. I mean, basic services have never worked very well, but I'm guessing they took a turn for the considerably worse. I mean, how are people getting by? Are people starving?
There is a severe food security crisis because last Monday, I think, the gangs attacked the port and they looted everything that was in the port. So that is gone, and there was a lot of food and things of that sort. But more importantly, the gangs control access to everything that is valuable. And you have that large population of internal refugees, something like 350,000 people, who have access to nothing. The government has obviously disappeared. But the type of NGO assistance that provided something is increasingly vanishing because they don't have access to the goods. All the hospitals are closed in Port-au-Prince now. If you are injured, well, only God can save you. The main hospital for people who don't have the means to go to a decent hospital is closed. You have a situation whereby food is extremely scarce, and if you don't have money, there is no food. People are going hungry. And access to any type of medical services is essentially gone. So this is a crisis of major proportion.
And finally, are we any closer to knowing who killed President Jovenel Moïse and why?
We don't know. I mean, obviously, some of the people who were involved in the assassination have been convicted, some of them in the United States. Last month, there was a judge in Haiti by the name of Voltaire who accused 51 political leaders of complicity in the assassination. And in that group, you had the wife of the president himself. You had the current prime minister.
Moïse's wife was in it.
Yeah. There have always been rumors that she was part of the plot, but that something went wrong. Now, whether that's true or not, no one knows. But that judge essentially said that she was complicit in it. That's one. Former prime ministers have been included. And there was also a very famous phone call between someone by the name of Badiou, who some think he was the intellectual architect of the assassination, to Ariel Henry, the one who's going to resign. There were two phone calls immediately after the assassination. And some people say that he must have known something or involved in something. Now, whether that's true or not, we don't know. But 51 political figures and some business figures were accused by that Judge Voltaire of complicity in the assassination. Now, nothing has happened since then because you can have a ruling by a judge, but the legal system has basically collapsed. So we'll just have to wait and see. But we are nowhere near a resolution of that mystery. But there are plenty of people who are candidates for complicity in the assassination itself.
That was Robert Fatala, professor of politics at the University of Virginia. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break.
Al Michale Matala! Tout moun mache bin embrase, bel amou akou la tombe. Pa gen moun nan pite deye, si sen se nou nou ni se fè. Men si yon nan nou anaje, la gaya gen tan deklare. Pati le gal yo ki rive, meti nan kon baka se plase. Pati le gal yo chef la ve a rive.
That was some of Bandit Legal, Creole for Legal Bandits, by Michel Martelly, a.k.a. Sweet Mickey, who is president of Haiti from 2011 to 2016. That was the song Robert Fatala mentioned earlier. Next, The Death of the Future. Steve Fraser, the writer and historian, has an article on the Jacobin magazine website that looks at how, across the political spectrum, we've all come to look to restoring the past as our ideal and not ambitiously transforming the deeply flawed world we inherited. While that might be appropriate for the right, although, as we'll hear, that's not an entirely accurate version of the right's history, it's not what the left has been about, nor should it be. Steve Fraser is not the Greco-Roman wrestler whom Google turns up when you search his name. This Steve Fraser is a historian, writer, and editor who's been analyzing American capitalism and its class structure for decades. And by class structure, I mean both working and ruling. I've personally found the book he co-edited, Ruling America, very useful in my understanding of our rotten elites. Among his other books are Every Man a Speculator, A History of Wall Street's Role in American Life, and The Age of Acquiescence, The Life and Death of American Resistance to Organized Wealth and Power. Steve Fraser. So you open the piece by looking at current labor-left politics. For example, the UAW's great victory over the auto companies, and by contemporary standards it was a great victory, but it was really merely regaining some of what's been lost since the era of concessions began, 40 years ago. And a lot of people who identify as socialists today, starting with Bernie Sanders, are just looking to restore the old New Deal order with adjustments for racial and gender justice. We're all sorely lacking in ambition, aren't we?
Yeah, that was that is the point of the article, ambition, vision, a sense that the future could be fundamentally different than anything we've ever known, but rather that we're content, if that's the right word, or resigned maybe is a better word, to at the very best restoring something that was better than what we have today, but is something from the past which had its own fundamental problems and flaws, but seems, in light of how crappy things are today, something to be struggled for, which is, you know, in a phrase, the New Deal order.
When did this idea of the future take hold in Western culture?
Well, I think the idea of the future takes hold with the birth of modern commercial life and the birth of a kind of individualist ethos, the beginnings of the breakdown of religious authority, and accelerates with the advent of capitalism, which is a very future-oriented system in its essence, inherently, and really took political shape with the great revolutions of the late 18th and 19th century, that the future could be something fundamentally different than people had ever known, which was a stunning idea, because for most of human history, certainly Western history, there is no sense of a future that's different. There's the afterlife that the Catholic Church and later Protestantism talked about, but that's afterlife elsewhere than on this planet. For most people, accepted the notion that life would be more or less basically the way it had always been, the same hierarchies would exist, and so on. With these revolutions and the development of commercial civilization, that a new attitude emerges that we associate with modernity, which is that the future is something fundamentally different. It's a story of progress, of human liberation, of scientific and technological advance, of a freeing of the human spirit. These are all things we associate with the birth of a notion of the future.
On the other side of the spectrum, the bourgeoisie itself seems to lack any ambition these days. It's a change from what is a revolutionary force. It doesn't have any social vision of a comprehensive vision of a society. As Balibar said, it doesn't really have a project of civilization. We can see this economically, low levels of public and private investment and the depredations of private equity and vulture capitalists who seem to be just eating our seed corn, as they say. It's not just us, right?
It's absolutely not just us, right? The bourgeoisie some time ago gave up any sense of a radically new future. In fact, even in the revolutionary age of the 18th, 19th century, it has its reservations because just exactly what that future was going to look like could be scary to the bourgeoisie. So that the great revolutions which establish fundamental democratic rights, end monarchy, do much to eliminate fixed hierarchies that feudal society was characteristic of. Those movements were pushed often from below by ordinary people who wanted to go even further than that and threaten the property relations that the bourgeoisie was invested in. So they developed reservations at a fairly early stage. But still, they were a force for change for a long, long time, for well more than a century. But in our time, they have long ago stopped being that. And really, the economic correlate of that we've lived through for the last 30 or 40 years, which is this system of disaccumulation, of a kind of parasitic capitalism, something I've called auto-cannibalism, eating itself alive, ruining the lives rather than improving the lives of ordinary working people, and settling for figuring out the mechanics of stabilizing, adjusting, keeping things in place without advancing any sense of a new future. Now, I would say very recently, in the last 10 years, maybe less, the American upper classes, parts of them, have gone over, pushed in that direction to a position of what has sometimes been called, for different reasons, woke capitalism, which means they are belatedly welcoming, for a variety of reasons, some of them quite cynical and material, gender, racial, and other forms of social justice, so long as they don't intrude upon capitalist relations. And this may give them a certain elan that they're fighting for the first time a progressive advance of a democratic sort. But basically, the society has no sense of a radically new future, either on the part of the bourgeoisie and really on the part of the left, and certainly on the part of the right, which is very invested in restoring a mythic version of something that died many, many decades ago.
How do the techno-utopians fit in this picture? They're very big on disruption and such. Do they have some sense of the future?
They think they have a sense of a different future. It's very technologically based. At its most ambitious, it depicts a society in which nobody works and in which there's a kind of luxuriating in idleness. Although some of these techno-utopians misunderstand, in my view, the actual import of technological advance, including artificial intelligence and information technology generally, which can work to implant a kind of subordination, all-consuming surveillance of the workplace, a de-skilling and degrading of work. But the techno-utopians sort of leap beyond that, even though that's what's going on in front of their eyes. More and more millions of working people are subject to this kind of information technology degradation and surveillance. And imagine this society where nobody works. And that, too, is a kind of degraded sense of utopia because work has a bad reputation under capitalist society, has a good and bad reputation because it is always exploitative and often oppressive and dehumanizing and turns people into machines and so on. But work is of the essence of what it means to be self-creative and socially creative. And the techno-utopians who are most utopian in their vision have forgotten that labor can include, should include in a healthy vision of the future, work that is a form of self and social expression, but they don't see things that way.
The right, now, of course, it's explicitly restorationist, and in Trumpism we've seen the intrusion of nostalgia into American politics of a really unprecedented sort. You know, it used to be everyone would talk about the future. Bill Clinton was all about the bridge to the 21st century, and Trump is looking back to 1955. What do you make of that?
In my little essay, I talk about how restorationism on the right, although we might assume is an old story, after all, conservatives conserve and want things to stay the same. It's really new because the radical right, by which I mean fascism, actually had a much more ambivalent relationship to restoring the past. They lived, the Nazis and Mussolini and the fascists in Italy, depicted a kind of mythical universe that paid its respects to a Teutonic past or to a Roman past, but really were very invested in creating what they called the new man, and were quite comfortable with modern technology, speed, change, even collectivism, which is anathema on the right today, which wants to restore an old individualism that they mythologize as a road to freedom. The fascist right of the mid-20th century was also inventive in its own sick way about creating something new in the world, because that was a moment in modern society where everybody was still invested in the hope of creating a new future. There's Bolshevism, obviously, which comes with the most enormous hope and optimism on the part of people who would grow to loathe it once it was in power, but saw it as the dawning of a new age for mankind. And fascism's part of that moment. The restorationist right today wants nothing to do with anything like that. Whether it's fascist or not is, to me, an open question, whether it will become so. But it doesn't share with fascism that delight or that enthusiasm for creating a new society. Instead, it wants to recapture this world of 1950 and mythologize it and romanticize it so that all of its obvious defects, which they might even acknowledge, are hidden or not talked about, so that patriarchy either is celebrated on the right or not talked about as much as it might be. The racial order that prevailed then is something that they are either would like to restore or would rather not acknowledge its persistent forms of oppression today. What's most remarkable about the right today, and a mark of what a desperate failure neoliberalism is that there is a thirst for that vision, that millions of people relate to that because their lives have become so otherwise anomic, stressful, isolated, socially despairing, and materially ruined by deindustrialization and so on, that they relate to this sense of the good old days, the nostalgia for that. And I do think it's incumbent upon the left to provide some alternative to that, a vision of society that speaks to their desires, not just their material needs, of course their material needs, but also their desires for a new way of life. For them, right now, a new way of life is the old way of life. And we on the left need to depict a different kind of new way of life in order to win at least some of them over to our movement.
I'm speaking with the writer and historian Steve Fraser. Now, there's a school of thought, and I'm thinking Raymond Williams, for example, that earlier episodes of popular radicalism were driven by memories of an old society that was destroyed by industrialization and the spreading of capitalist social relations. It doesn't seem to be working that way now. It seems to be just leading to an outright nostalgia.
Yeah, I agree with that, and that's a profound problem, because I do think Raymond Williams and others, and even I have written about this, that the shock of capitalism, its barbarism, its exploitation, its devastation of whole ways of life, was shocking to people who knew older ways of life and used that memory of their past to oppose capitalism, even to become socialists. They draw on the past to invent a new future, to destroy the present and invent a new future. Even the Knights of Labor were like that. They drew on past memories of artisanal independence, which was now at forfeit by the industrial capitalism, and instead dreamed not of restoring artisanal independence, but of establishing, for example, a cooperative commonwealth, a new vision of how men and women could live together in a healthy way. And so I think that's always been the case, that the past can play two roles, one as a kind of inspiration for destroying the present and creating a new future, or it can be a trap, as I think it's becoming certainly for the right and can be for the left, insofar as the far horizon of their thinking goes no further than the past, than the New Deal. I was speaking to a class the other day about the early years of radical union activity in New York City around the turn of the 20th century. And I made the point that leftists normally have an equation that you have capitalism, you have workers caught in it. If they're going to advance beyond it, they first begin by finding means of collective resistance in their workplace. They form unions, to be rather simple about it. They form unions. The unions teach them certain lessons about collective action, of collective group interest, of class interest, and they advance through that school of the trade union movement of collective bargaining to socialism, we hope. I mean, that's a crude diagram. The formula is no unions, no socialism. And what I argued in this class the other night was that, on the contrary, if you look at that period of the great needle trades uprisings in New York City at the turn of the century, what you have instead is people already infused with an anti-capitalist culture. Some of them socialists, some of them anarchists, some of them syndicalists, various kinds of radicals and knights of labor. They're infused in New York City and elsewhere in the country with a kind of anti-capitalism that comes from their shock at what this new capitalism is producing. And it's that which drives their uprisings in 1909 and 1913, thousands and thousands join unions that are explicitly, these are unions, this is not some little left sect, that are explicitly revolutionary. They say it in their constitutions. They say it in their preambles. In other words, the formula really was no socialism, no unions. What came first? It was the socialism which drove their unionization and became very powerful unions. Now, there's a long history about what happens after that and why collective bargaining becomes the raison d'etre for their existence and not revolution, but that's another chapter. But what I'm arguing here is that the past for them was a kind of inspiration for a future that reverses the logic that the left now thinks is inexorable, that first you start with unions or things like that, and it's like from you graduate from elementary school to graduate school and then you have a revolution. History works in mysterious ways. Where that leaves us today, I don't know, because there are no such memories today. However, there are other things happening today which are threatening to ruin the lives of people and shock them. Just the way information, cognitive capitalism, and decentered neoliberal capitalism has destroyed any sense of security, has produced massive demoralization in the society, has produced a looming climate disaster which is affecting more and more people. There's no memory of a pre-capitalist past. There's no memory of a society that wasn't founded on wage labor, but there are catastrophic things happening that may shake people out of. And I think, after all, the DSA's growth and the Sanders phenomenon, however limited they may be, also are testament to a kind of new anti-capitalist energy in our society, especially in America, where such things were unheard of for a half century.
The mainstream discourse of DSA, I'm talking about the public discourse, people say it, members say different things privately, don't really talk much about the ownership of the means of production or the reorganization of work in any fundamental way. Why not? What's happening?
It's probably an overdetermined process. This fear, I don't mean literally they're afraid, but they're afraid implicitly. In 1945, you could talk about socialism and you could talk about a lot of things you can't talk about now. The Cold War was a profound purging of our language and of our minds collectively, all of that kind of anti-capitalist culture. So thoroughgoing that it actually shut down even forms of protest that were not anti-capitalist. And that had a lasting kind of impact. I think the daily life of people, and we're all just living in a society together, whether we're left-winger or not, you know, neoliberalism plays on desires that have been inculcated for a long time in our society, and it produces social isolation and a sense of cynicism or skepticism. Look, Bolshevism was a disaster. There's been endless defeats of anti-capitalist movements over the last 20, 30 years. The notion of utopia has suffered such severe censure that to talk about it suggests you're woolly-headed or worse, or that you're incipient totalitarian, so that the word itself no longer is permissible in polite company unless you're, you know, some lunatic fringe. That's part of the lesson of 20th century capitalism. As horrid as it may sound, the death of the Soviet Union in 1990. I mean, it's 2 years later that Fukuyama produces his book about the end of history. That is to say, the last existing, however putrid, form of alternative was done, dead. All of these things produce a kind of silence about, is an embarrassment. And then there's a lot of defeats. I mean, all the high hopes that the Seattle demonstrations in 1999 against the WTO produced were defeated. Neoliberalism marches on despite massive protests, say around the Iraq War, for example, efforts in Europe, especially in Greece, but elsewhere, to resist the power of the banking elite failed and caused abject forms of surrender. This is very demoralizing. The Sanders phenomenon here, enormously inspiring, and then defeat. That hurts. The left has suffered many defeats in its history, also great victories. The sense of defeat, of defeatism, which drives people away from raising transcendent hopes.
There are some exceptions on the left about ambition, the post-work school or the degrowth school. What do you think of them? How do they fit into your critique?
Degrowth, we need to get out of a world which is hyper-competitive and driven by a narrow vision of what progress really means, a kind of techno vision of what progress means. I agree with that. But we're talking about a planet of billions of people, and degrowth seems to me to be an impossible way of dealing healthily and providing a level of life together that I guess I retain a faith in a certain inventiveness of human beings and social creativity. You know, one of the more telling commitments of the left, some of the left, to the New Deal is this notion of the Green New Deal, which does rely in the end on capitalism as a form of economic organization that will nonetheless produce various forms of alternative energy. I think that's true. I think it can. I don't believe it can't. But I think what we need to develop are expressly collective socialist means of developing alternative sources of energy, but not retreat from that commitment to the well-being of the Earth's population.
And the post-work crowd?
Marx's vision of being a fisherman in the morning and a critical critic in the afternoon is what I adhere to, by which I mean he never thought, and I don't think, that the object of socialist society is no work. Obviously, tedious work, monotonous work, oppressive work, exploitative work are all things the socialist movement wants to abolish, but not work, unless you narrowly define work in the way that capitalism has defined it, and is one of the reasons people don't believe in the future, because the capitalist future produced this kind of oppressive work. What we're about as socialists is creating a society in which people work, labor, create as a way of developing themselves as human beings and developing each other as human beings. The post-work ethos suggests to me a kind of passivity, inertia, kind of, I remember Norman O'Brown, what's his famous book, I'm forgetting now.
Oh, Life Against Death, right?
Yes, the image was a kind of daffodil blowing in the wind, that was sort of like the object of at one with nature, still not a creator. Homo Faber is a creator.
And now we're afflicted by a very serious dystopianism. Insofar as there's anything about the future, it's often very dark and bad. Is that an innovation?
Well, there's always been dystopias, but I think now dystopia far, far, far outweighs any utopian thinking. I mean, you know, there were dystopias written at the height of the Gilded Age in America when resistance and senses of a different future other than capitalism was rampant throughout the country. But today, it overwhelms in novels, in movies, in cartoons. It's understandable. I mean, you know, we're looking at this climate thing that looks like an ongoing dystopia. The hopelessness of our lives, our sense that there is no future, is itself inherently dystopian. It's hard not to be, to resist the impulse to be dystopian. You have this slaughter going on, this genocide going on in Gaza. It's the signature fantasy life of a kind of decrepit, parasitical form of capitalism. That tells us a lot about the obstacles we as leftists have in trying to overcome that. It's both promising in a perverse sort of way insofar as people are incipiently ready for something new and different, but also despairing about the possibility of that.
And the obligatory final question, is there a cure?
Yeah, I don't know. I'll tell you one thing that has occurred to me of late. When I look back to the Jewish socialists or the Italian anarchists, turn of the century, you can say many things about them. They had this right, they had that wrong. But a lot of them, Trotsky said an interesting thing. I think I mentioned this in my article, that history and revolutionary movements particularly are kind of an amalgam of the archaic and the modern. I believe in the secular sacred, that is to say, which is the title of an article a long time ago, I think by Daniel Bell of all people. But anyway, that is to say, it was socialism before unions. That's my point, that there has to be a sense of outrage and inspirational vision of the future to get at this problem. Not the more pedestrian, long-honored tradition of step-by-step, we organize, then we politicize, then we so on and so forth. Leftists have to infuse into their day-to-day organizing activity and political activity an active sense of a different future.
That was the writer and historian Steve Fraser. His article, The End of the Future, is on the Jacobin website. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Arkora by the Icelandic composer Anna Torvaldsdottir, performed by the Iceland Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Eva Ola Kanin. Till next week, bye.